I don't know if somebody is putting out an ad that raises a red flag to me because they're trying to do something bad or because they don't realize that just because all their friends are doing it, that it's a problem. And I mean, my job is when clients are concerned about that and they come to me is for me to explain, here's the risk. Here's what you, there are some things that are black and white you can and cannot do. Some of it is like, if you're going to do this, here's how risky that is. And so it's not really, I think, fair for me to just like dunk on people that seem like they're screwing up online. And it's also just not really like productive. Like I would hope that maybe that person, assuming they're not an obvious scam, there right. are some of those, like I'm not just going to represent people that obviously have no interest in running a legitimate business.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Higher Standard Podcast, where we give you ultra-premium, unfiltered truth when it comes to building your wealth and curating the lifestyle of your dreams. No games, no drama, and no shenanigans. I am your host, Chris Nahibi, and I'm here to help you distill the immense amount of information and disinformation out there on the interwebs and give you the opportunity to choose a higher standard for yourself. There are no gurus here, and no one gives a damn about how wealthy you look. I'm an attorney and a banker, amongst other things. Does that mean you should listen to me? Hell no. This is just full disclosure that while we talk about money, wealth, law, investing, and a lot of related topics, you should always speak to your own advisors for an opinion tailored to your unique investment perspective. I am obligated to tell you that nothing contained in this show is in fact legal or investment advice and is being provided solely for entertainment purposes. So sit back, relax your mind, and get ready for a different kind of podcast where we elevate your baseline in crispy, high-resolution audio. This isn't a different standard. It's the higher standard. Welcome back to the podcast, friends. I have been gone for a little bit. You didn't notice it, but I was on a vacation with the wife, did some traveling for work, came back. The whole time I was on social media, I was kind of looking at stuff while I'm on these, you know, three-hour plane rides. You know, we're flying with the family and you get some time to look at social media. I was checking out a lot of stuff online and the advertising, the slippery nature of some of the stuff that I was seeing really frustrated me. And I know of an expert, Robert Frund. He's an experienced litigator, but he's got big firm experience. This guy's a UC Davis law guy. I mean, he has all the pedigree you could possibly want. And he happens to specialize in advertising compliance and litigation with an emphasis on e-commerce and social media marketing issues. And me, as an attorney, I've gotten so much useful information from his page. I reached out to him, said, hey, man, I know you and I have connected before. Would you be interested in being the podcast? To my surprise, he said, yes. Why? I don't know anybody would ever want to talk to me. But he's here to share some experience and wisdom with you. We get into some of the things that you probably already heard about, like celebrities being sued because they're using photos of themselves taken by somebody else on their own social media page. And this kind of changing landscape of what's going on, because intellectual property, whether we recognize it or not, is a thing and you have to be respectful of it and you can't always mitigate your risk. People are losing their Instagram pages. Things are changing. It's a dynamic world. And now there might be a metaverse. It's complicated. So Robert breaks it down for us, helps us understand some of his frustrations from a legal perspective, tells us some things that he's experienced. And more than anything else, it's just a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoy it. But before we jump into this, I want to say a special shout out to my team. By now, by the time you've heard this episode, we've recorded a lot for a long time. This podcast would be nothing without them. I'm just some dude with no experience behind a mic. And this team, you know, Jay, David, and the rest of his team out there have really been crushing it to bring you this quality content. I appreciate you guys. I appreciate what they've done for me. If you like the podcast, don't forget to share it. Take a listen to what Robert has to say. It may change the way you interact with social media and the way you think about posting your own content. Let's jump into it. Welcome to the podcast, my friend. I've been super excited to talk to you, not only because you're a way better attorney than I could ever hope to be, but largely because you're in a space that is super fascinating to me. So if you could help me help everybody out there understand how you got to doing what you do for a living.
Yeah, so I'm an advertising attorney and I focus on e-commerce and social media marketing issues. So basically, if you sell stuff online or you help people sell stuff online, I help you do it in a way that lets you keep the money you earn rather than spending it on litigation or giving it over to the government or something else that could be avoided if you're paying attention to risk and understanding what the traps are. My background was in sort of general business litigation. I was a large law firm called Greenberg Traurig for close to 7 years. And most of what I did there, especially towards the last like 5 years or so, was consumer class action defense stuff for big companies. And in California especially, there's a ton of that activity, and a lot of it has to do with advertising claims. Whether it's, you know, the label says all natural and it's not all natural, stuff like that, or the product had some quality that someone is now claiming it doesn't have, things like that. And as part of that work, we also had clients who would come to us to try to get ahead of those problems and do the function that a general counsel in-house might do. So, for example, we had a big video game client come to us that said, look, we're about to launch this game. Please look over all of our ad copy. And if you can tell us what the risks are and what we might need to change or at least be aware of, then hopefully we won't have to call you guys back in 6 months and get us out of some sticky situation. I really like doing that work more than litigating. Clients are usually a lot happier in that situation when they're not embroiled in a lawsuit. And it's just more fun work for me to do. So when I decided that staying at a large law firm for my whole career was not going to be for me, I thought, all right, well, if I leave and start my own practice, what does that ideally look like? And it was that kind of consulting type, like litigation avoidance work around advertising and working with entrepreneurs and people who I can relate to a little bit better than a lot of the large institutional clients at a firm like that. And so that's what I've tried to do. And it's worked out nicely so far. A fair amount of that is luck. I'd be happy to talk about that. But now I have the luxury of choosing the clients I want to work with. They're in the advertising and e-commerce space. And it's exciting for me because it's in the realm of law, it's as interesting to me as it could be versus some of the other stuff I was doing previously. And yeah, I'm fortunate to get to choose the clients I like working with now.
So I found you originally via Instagram. And I don't know how significant of a marketing channel that is for your practice, but you clearly touch on a lot of relevant things, particularly in the social media space, a lot of the influencer-based marketing stuff, a lot of mitigation of risk, a lot of things that people are doing consistently out there on social media. As somebody who's in that space, how impactful is your social media presence for you?
It's incredibly important for me. And I did not set out with the intention of, all right, I'm going to build an Instagram following and that will be how I get clients. That was not really a route for marketing that I was exposed to, certainly at my old firm. And it just sort of came about. I was at a networking type event with somebody explaining what I do, explaining that I work with social media influencers and paying attention to what's going on in that space. And he said, well, let me see your Instagram. And at the time I had like 3 posts. It was a placeholder. It was nothing. And he's like, well, if you're doing this, you need to be putting out content there. And he said, take a look at what this CPA is doing. There's this guy, Tyler McBroom. At the time he had like 100,000 followers. I think he's got close to like 1 million now. And his thing is like 1 minute videos. Here's a tax tip for your business, or here's a common misconception about writing off vehicles or something like that.
Right.
And this friend of mine was like, you should just do that with common legal issues you see. And I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. And so I just started doing that. And I had this is sort of the luck part I was talking about. I had a couple larger pages, a couple people I had met through speaking at conferences, and other people that I guess somehow became aware of my page shared it without me asking them to, and without them even really knowing me very well yet. And when a page that is connected with someone who's respected in your industry shares your stuff just because they like it, that's incredibly helpful. And that helped me out a lot, and that just sort of got the momentum going. And then it's just like being consistent about posting, and now that's probably 95% of where I get my clients is through Instagram, which is still a weird thing for me to say, but that's where it's at now. And I know that I need to diversify and get on other platforms, and I'm going to do that. But yeah, right now, I mean, social media has been huge for me.
I made the leap to TikTok not too long ago, and I got to tell you, it was not without, it was definitely not without its mistakes. And I made a lot of, I haven't danced, thank God, yet on a video, but it's funny because in the legal profession, there's a lot of stigma to having social media and having that kind of presence, at least a public presence that's out there. It's funny that it's worked so well for you, given the fact that a traditional legal environment would probably tell you not to do that.
Absolutely. There is no way I would be able to post a lot of the things that I do, especially on my stories where I'm just sort of being casual and on weekends and stuff. I mean, it wasn't done, first of all. And then if I wanted to propose doing it, there's so many levels that it would need to clear that it would just never happen in time, number one, to be relevant. Like sometimes I'll check my news sites about what's going on. I'll see a story that would make a great little blurb or a 1 minute digest and relate that to something else that's going on. But if you have to have that cleared by some committee over the course of 4 or 5 days, it's stale. And so it's really nice to have the luxury of figuring out how I want to market and then just doing it and not having to go through any other step than that. If it doesn't work, then it won't work and I'll do something else. But yeah, I think one of the lessons that I learned was like, especially if you're in an area that has maybe been reluctant to embrace social media, that is a great opportunity to be in a smaller group of people doing it and get more attention. Like every law firm has a blog. I don't know how many people read it. I read them sometimes just so that I'm not missing anything that's out there. But I don't know how great a marketing tool that is. I'd love to see numbers on that. But I do know that if you are in a profession that's been hesitant to get on social media, then you have such an advantage because you have so much less competition for that attention.
Yeah, totally. And the funny, so a client of mine and a friend was telling me kind of how The Rock and Kevin Hart ultimately, you know, structured their contracts for social media. At the time, I wasn't really on social media, but they were telling me how they had leveraged this as their personal brand. And if you were to do a film with either one of these two, you actually signed a contract, a separate contract for access to their social media promotion. And if you think about that in the context of a business or, you know, a movie production house in their case, that extra pop that you get from their direct access to their people who want to see their product anyway was such a huge thing. It wound up being multi-million dollar contracts for these guys.
Yeah.
And the light bulb went on with me, like, you know what, the way we think as a society in a professional sense about social media has changed so much that I think we're out of date. I think we're largely out of date.
Yeah, that doesn't really surprise me that they're able to command such a fee for social media presence. I mean, you think about the size of their audience and then how much time the average person spends on their phone and on Instagram every day. It's like, it used to be, I guess, people would spend, and maybe some still do, like 4 or 5 hours a day on watching TV. If you're spending 5 hours on your phone and you get shown The Rock story 10 times, that's like the equivalent of getting an ad on TV for that person 10 times. So it totally makes sense that would charge or command a hefty fee to get that kind of omnipresence when people are on their phones.
And it's cross-platform too. Now you're seeing it on TikTok. It's funny. I heard the statistic the other day that on TikTok, it surpassed YouTube with total watch time per month. And they were 24 hours per month versus YouTube at 22 hours and 40 minutes. But when you think about it in a broader sense, that doesn't include the other platforms that people are also on at the same time. Think about how much time we're consuming this. And then I look at your practice. Your practice can only be getting bigger, right? It can only be getting more volume based on the amount of activity people have on social media and the lack of appreciation for intellectual property in that space.
Yeah, I think it's largely an education problem. There's not that many people that are going to set out and be like, all right, I'm starting a new business. Let me make sure I read all this legal information so that I educate myself about all the issues. And there's not also that many people that will say, all right, in my first year of being in business or whatever I'm pursuing, one of the first things I'm going to do is hire a legal team to make sure that I'm doing everything correctly. It's just not top of mind, and it doesn't seem like a priority for a lot of people. So I understand why there's a lack of awareness around what seems like simple issues, like whose picture can I use in my ads and when? And when do I have the right to use content that someone else created? And things that can really become financial and emotional problems for you if you slip up with them. So I think it's really just the reason why that stuff comes up so frequently is just people are not aware. And so what I hope is an effect of the stuff I put out is like at least some more people will be aware of it, especially if they're not the sorts of people that will be like, all right, before I use some content, I'm going to go to some legal blog about copyright law or watch a YouTube video specifically on it. Maybe they'll see what I'm putting out and maybe that gets shared and someone can avoid having to go through that process.
Well, I mean, some of your posts scared the shit out of me. I was reading the one the other day where you tell, where, I mean, I knew it was out there, but I didn't realize the implications. Even if you take a photo of yourself that somebody else took and posted it to your page, there are legal repercussions for that, right?
Yeah. And that kind of case is brought all the time. It's just because you are in a photograph or a video doesn't mean that you can do anything with it. In fact, you can't do anything with it unless that's not totally true. There are a lot of things you cannot do with that content unless you have a license from the photographer who owns the rights to it or the videographer by default. So unless you have some agreement that says, yes, you can use this content I created for whatever purpose you're using it for, then the default is that if you post a picture of yourself that you didn't take, you are committing copyright infringement. Now, the effect of that depends on the circumstances and how you're using it and if it was registered and so on. But yeah, it seems backwards that I can't use a picture that someone took of myself on my own page, but you can't unless you have permission.
Well, and it's insane. It's funny because we think about public figures and celebrities, but this could apply to micro-influencers, people who have like a small blog, right? I mean, if someone takes a photo of you at an event and you post it and share it, and that happens to be somebody who protected his IP, you could face, you know, some significant pushback, right? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a possibility that if someone was very aggressive about policing their IP rights and they registered all their photos with the Copyright Office, which is not difficult to do, and they were really policing every instance of where that winds up on the internet. And there are businesses where that is the business model. Like, send us your content and we will do our damnedest to find every instance of it on the website and then fire off all these demand letters. And you sort of ignore those at your peril. So yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility that if you posted a picture of yourself, if you're not famous, that you might get one of these copyright infringement demands from someone.
And what I try to tell people too is even if you're not a celebrity and someone's not telling you, hey, I'm going to sue you for a lot of money, if they report that to Instagram or TikTok, those copyright, you know, dings add up. Those are how you get your accounts taken down. If you have a couple of those, two, three, who knows what the number is, I mean, you can say goodbye to your Instagram account and all the time and effort you put into building content, creating content, and being out there on social media, right? I mean, it's got implications.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's this sort of, well, are they really going to take me to court issue, which is kind of a maybe. And maybe, you know, there's some situations where there's less of a chance of that. But yeah, the platforms have their own rules. And if you're like me and you depend on Instagram and you do something that puts you in a situation where that tool can be taken from you, it's extremely difficult to get Instagram to reverse a decision. Sometimes those decisions aren't even made by people. It's some sort of rubric that enough boxes get checked and action gets taken. And then you might never get a live person to actually respond to that situation. So yeah, it's important to pay attention to platform rules in addition to the letter of the law about them.
It's funny because you and I were talking before we started recording about a mutual friend, at least people that we know. And I got a call, I think it was two nights ago, from a friend. And he said, my account, verified account, this guy's got, you know, a television show. He's been on my show before. He's a nice guy. I know he hasn't had any copyright violations, but his account was taken down. He has no explanation, no email, no nothing. And he's beside himself with, that was just like you. It was a big point of his business model and how he interacted with people and how he connected, how he went to seminars and how he did things. And to have that completely gone, I mean, I can't imagine if anybody, I mean, I equate it to like in the late 90s, like you changing your mobile number.
Right.
Like you essentially just vanished. Like no one's going to be able to find you, right?
Right.
So it's astonishing. So what are the pitfalls you see? I mean, obviously, you see this more than most, but what are the pitfalls you see with people online, you know, with their social presence, that the mistakes you see routinely over and over again? Like, what's the commonality here?
Easily the most common issue is what we just talked about, using content that you don't have a license to use even on something as seemingly harmless like a travel blog where you're taking a picture of maybe even a famous site in Germany, let's say, and that that photographer has retained a law firm where their entire business is just sending out, cranking out demand letters for that person's photographs, and you have to deal with it. Like the consequences of ignoring a demand letter and then having to work it out in court can be extremely expensive and distracting and stressful and so on. And that issue just comes up constantly. There's that. And then from a brand perspective, there's a lot of misunderstandings about using content that other people create for you. So a sort of classic example is like, if you're a company that makes shirts or something, and you send a free shirt to some influencer, and you ask that they create one Instagram story in exchange for this shirt, hope you like it, that sort of thing. Then that person goes and creates an Instagram story and posts it. A lot of times the brand will assume, okay, great, they've created that video for us and we can do whatever we want with it. So maybe we'll take 10 of those unboxings and put a little song behind it and it becomes a YouTube ad. Unless you have a contract saying, I get to use that, the brand get to use that Instagram story commercially, then you have potentially a publicity rights problem and a copyright problem when you use that content in your own ad. So just because someone else created content for your brand, it doesn't mean that you get to use it everywhere. And it doesn't mean that you automatically get to, if the person's in the content, like if they're featured in the video, it doesn't mean that you get to use their name and likeness in your ads. And that hypothetical situation I just gave comes up all the time also. And that it's the kind of thing that can be very easily avoided and just sorted out ahead of time. If you're thinking through like, okay, what are all the ways that I could potentially want to use this content that someone's going to create for me? Let me make sure that we have something in writing where they understand what they're giving up and what we're getting and vice versa. And then that way, if there's some dispute, we can really quickly just go back to that agreement and say, you know, we value this relationship as you might remember or something like that. And then you attach it and then that's it. Rather than, okay, now we have to pay five times what we had anticipated paying this person to sort out this potential lawsuit.
It's funny because it frames so many things that we see all the time and we don't think about. Like if I were to send someone like a Kim Kardashian, like, a product and she were to use it, it'd be so tempting as a brand for me to say, oh, look, she used this product. And I can just totally imagine her legal team is armed and ready for that kind of stuff all of the time, all damn day. Not to mention you would get a bump anyway from just her social presence. But I can just see how you look back at like tabloids and you look back at like People magazine talking about how certain celebrities are using certain products. I think a lot of times on social media, people don't understand that a lot of that was curated content back then that was structured with the advertiser, with the individual there. And it was all put together in a way to make it look like a casual article.
Right.
But when an individual does it without that, I guess, self-awareness, it winds up being just ripe with lawsuit potential, right? I mean,
yeah. And that entire issue of advertising not looking like advertising touches on the FTC component of influencer marketing, which they have been getting signaled they're going to be more aggressive about. Making sure that people disclose when an ad is an ad. That's sort of one of the FTC's fundamental missions, is making sure that people understand when they're being advertised to, and there's a natural tension there between that goal and the goal of influencer marketing itself, which is, let's make this not really look like an ad, but a recommendation from a friend or someone you've grown to trust or relate to.
Yep.
And so there's, you know, I see my job as not saying no to every potential ad campaign that has legal risk. Because if I did that, then very few ads would run. It's more like, let me help you understand what the risks are, and to the extent I can, where it falls on the risk spectrum, and make sure that you understand all the potential consequences of taking on risk. And then it's really a business decision of how much risk you want to take on with full knowledge, or as close to full knowledge as possible, about what might happen.
It's funny because a simple thing can become so complicated. My question for someone like the FTC is it's funny as you see the regulation of ads, no one's stopping like the scams and the shenanigans that are going online. Like everybody and their mother's selling courses now. We know that that can be either, you know, completely legitimate or completely manipulated. And yet no, I don't even know if there's a regulatory body whose sole focus is to step in on stuff like that.
Yeah, it really is the task of the FTC. I think we're going to see more activity around it. I mean, they have had a few big cases around education products generally. There was a thing called Online Trading Academy, I think it was.
Oh yeah.
I can't remember the figure of the judgment or settlement or whatever it was, but it was a pretty significant ruling against that organization. And it was brought by the FTC. And they've gone after for-profit universities that say things like, our graduates make X amount of money when they leave here, if they're not disclosing that that's not really what you can expect to earn, things like that. They sent out a flurry of warning letters either last week or the week before, specifically talking about earnings claims, where if you're going to sell a product or a service and you're going to show, look at what this person who used this product ended up making, and that is not what the typical user can expect to make. There's a series of disclosures you have to make about what that typical expected result is, and it can't be buried in the fine print. It has to be clear and conspicuous in all of this. And that's not a new rule, but the fact that the FTC sent out all these letters saying, like, heads up, this is the rule, we still really care about it, and you're now on notice that this is our position, and if we catch you violating it, then we can go to court and get this higher penalty amount than we would if we hadn't sent this letter. So I think that's pretty much a guarantee that they're going to go after some entities that they think are violating that rule, whether it's courses or some other MLM type structure where you're promising, or at least making it seem like, if you buy into this, you can expect to make X. That's not only true, but also presented in a way that discloses the typical result, then you're going to have a problem. So they can't be everywhere at once. There's always going to be people that get away with stuff on the internet because it's so easy to advertise and be anonymous and so on. But I think that warning letter move by the FTC at least indicates that they're going to try to be more active in that area.
Can you imagine how underfunded they are to fight that war? I mean, I don't know what their staffing looks like, but if you just took Instagram, not all social media, just Instagram, and you were to police some of the stuff that we see all the time, how many times do you see an influencer or somebody posting, you know, here's my receipts from whatever business they're in, or here's my check? Can you imagine how much staffing they would need? Even Instagram can't police this. They have to use an algorithm, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, they can't be everywhere. They're not unlimited. I mean, there's also state attorneys general can bring the same sorts of cases. And there's opportunity for class actions to sort of keep a check on that too. But yeah, there's too much of that kind of activity for everyone to get caught. Like it's always going to be a feature of the internet. But I think what the FTC hopes to achieve by bringing some more of these cases is at least put people on notice, because some people don't even understand that it's against the law to make those kinds of representations. Like they just don't, they didn't realize like, well, my one student made $1 million. So I can advertise that. Well, not really if 1,000 other students lost money and like not everyone realizes that that's an issue. So there's the education problem again, but yeah, the scams are always going to be out there. And hopefully when those larger cases make headlines, people who might be persuaded by something that's inauthentic would at least have their radar up a little bit and say, well, what is this company? Let me look them up. Let me see if this actually exists. Where are they located? Things like that, like basic due diligence.
So you either have like massive self-restraint or I've just never seen it, but I've never seen you check anybody online for like BS claims that are totally illegal. And there's a lot out there. Like I've seen people who don't understand the law clearly in conversations, some of which, like, you know, on a couple of pages that you and I both follow, where people are clearly misunderstanding the law. That's got to be aggravating as hell for you to read that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's really not my job to call people out. And I prefer not to make posts sometimes I'll make posts about a lawsuit being filed. I like to sort of wait to see where it falls and like what the result is, because I don't know necessarily, I don't know if somebody is putting out an ad that raises a red flag to me because they're trying to do something bad or because they don't realize that just because all their friends are doing it, that it's a problem. And I mean, my job is when clients are concerned about that and they come to me is for me to explain, here's the risk. Here's what you, there are some things that are black and white you can and cannot do. Some of it is like, if you're going to do this, here's how risky that is. And so it's not really, I think, fair for me to just like dunk on people that seem like they're screwing up online. And it's also just not really like productive. Like I would hope that maybe that person, assuming they're not an obvious scam, there right. are some of those, like I'm not just going to represent people that obviously have no interest in running a legitimate business, but the ones that maybe are, and they're just screwing up, there's, I would hope that they would reach out to an attorney like me and say like, is this okay? And then when they're told no, they make changes or at least appreciate what's going on. So yeah, there's no upside to me just like calling out bullshit on the internet. I think there's a couple accounts that do that very well, and that's sort of their domain.
And it's tempting as hell. You know, it's funny how many times I find myself getting frustrated with what is probably a 15-year-old like high school kid who doesn't understand things, and it's prevalent that you have kind of this disinformation out there. But what's crazy to me is to see that there's so many mature adults that are in the business world that also don't understand some of the core concepts as it relates to their, you know, their legal rights. They don't understand, you know, I'm not saying that we as people who, you know, went to law school and did all those things have a superior knowledge base. There's some stuff that honestly we should all have a basic core understanding of when you graduate school, like freedom of speech and what that looks like, that people just don't understand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that education gap or understanding gap is, there's so many areas that cuts across when you're talking about understanding of how the law works. And there's ideas that just sort of get misreported and then people accept that that's true. And admittedly, it's hard to figure out what the rules are about everything. And, you know, especially if you're running a business, there's other things that are more pressing. But yeah, I am still surprised by, from time to time, people who should know better, in my opinion. And how some sophisticated business owners are still misled by other scammers. That stuff still is impressive to me.
I've lost money to scammers. There's no point in lying about it. If it wasn't for the help of some people, I could have lost, you know, $30,000, almost $40,000 at one point just because I didn't know any better. I get how it happens. It's sad that it does because we all think that we're smart people inherently, and because we're smart people, we just know things. But that's like a lawyer going into a real estate, you know, business saying, I could do this because I'm a smart person, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, we've all made those mistakes. But what's fascinating about your particular area is that it's dynamically changing so much. I mean, look at how Facebook has been being able to say, hey, we're not responsible for policing the activities here. You know, we're kind of an independent, neutral platform. Do you see that changing? Do you see that impacting your business?
That issue, that is one that I was sort of thinking of about how there's sort of misunderstanding about how that dynamic works. So, and I was thinking about that when we were talking about pages getting disabled. I've had a lot of requests over the last few years of people wanting me to send demand letters or sue Facebook to get their accounts back. And you cannot do that. It's like one of the few that is not going to happen. Literally every single lawsuit that has ever attempted to sue a social media platform to get an account back has failed. And the reason for that is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And it's just a brick wall that no one is getting through unless and until there's some reform of that law or some Supreme Court decision or something that changes the way we've all, or the courts have interpreted it. But it's just not happening. They have the freedom or the ability, I guess you could say, to allow whatever content they want on there and to remove whatever content they want on there, full stop. So I don't see that really changing in the short term. There's nothing that's really out there that looks like, okay, this is serious Section 230 reform that will mean Facebook will now be liable for silencing a certain viewpoint. It's just, maybe that will happen. There seems to be mounting social pressure to restructure how Facebook and these other big tech platforms work, and a lot of influential people in politics have a lot to say about Section 230, but it's not like, yeah, next year that'll be different. It seems like that's not really going away anytime soon.
And I mean, and it is political. I mean, to your point, it's super political. There's a lot there. But I was having this conversation last night with my content team. You know, they helped me produce the content for the social media, and they were over here. We were talking about the guy that I know who lost his account. And they're like, well, can't you just write a letter, to your point, the demand letter? And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, no, I can't write a demand letter for anybody. I can go to the normal portal channels to reclaim stuff that a PR platform would have, but that's really asking them for permission. It's not saying, hey, you have to do this. And I think people think that just because it seems like a public forum, like it seems like it's not a private company. And I'm like, guys, like this is essentially, you know, somebody owns this business. Now, whether it's shareholders and it's public and your context of that happening, you know, this is not the government.
Right.
And I think people misalign their thoughts with that. But then I was thinking in the context of like the metaverse, right? Facebook's going through this whole change. I understand that there's a lot of proponents out there who are saying, you know, they're not going to own it, but they're trying to own it, and it should be blockchain based and all this other stuff. But let's get theoretical for a minute. Let's say there is a metaverse at some point in time. Let's say people are putting on VR goggles and they're out there. They're now living in this virtual world. Can you imagine how much of the wild, wild west that might be in terms of like intellectual property law? I mean, NFTs are one thing, but there's just, who knows?
Yeah.
It's untouched territory.
It would certainly make things a lot messier. And it would be another situation of, we need to take laws that were written in some cases 50 or more years ago and try to figure out how to apply them to technology that's changing at an increasing rate of change. Like, it's not linear, it's exponential. So that has always been sort of a battleground around just copyright issues generally. Like, the Copyright Act was not written with the internet involved, and now we have ways to share files immediately that nobody could have really predicted would happen. And now we're talking about things like the metaverse. Like,
right.
That is a huge leap from something like Napster that was its own colossal mess for many years, and still there's thorny issues around, you know, streaming services and things like that. So yeah, when you're talking about, let's put another layer on top of how people interact online, which makes it more like the real world, then yeah, you can expect a lot of money spent trying to sort out how intellectual property laws apply to that new situation.
It's astonishing for me to think the exponential growth that, I mean, as somebody who does this for a living, right, and you deal with clients who are in this space and it's currently evolving and social media is still growing, do you feel like a lot of the law is well settled and well healed in what you do, or do you feel like there's still a lot of catch up to do and does it make your job easier or more complex? I mean, how do you feel about where that sits?
What it means for me is I just need to pay attention to how courts are handling these situations. Like, if a law changes, then that has a certain effect. But when laws are slow to change, like legislatures don't move quickly, and when they do, I mean, I could get on a whole tangent about California's privacy laws and what a dumpster fire that is. But generally,
anything that's a dumpster fire, man, let's do it.
To your question, like, what it means for me is I need to be paying attention to how courts handle these issues when they're presented with them, because that's how we determine what the rules are. Other than that, it's just sort of like theorizing. And I can present an argument about how I think something applies if a court has not addressed it yet. But a big part of my day is like making sure things aren't falling through the cracks in my understanding of how these pieces work together. And that's what makes it interesting, is like the premise of false advertising, for example, is not new. Like, the rules around it have been pretty much set about the factors a court will look at for under the Lanham Act or something like that. It's just the facts we're now applying those rules to are different. And are the new methods of marketing, does that change how we apply the law to the facts in a way that makes a big difference? So the part that keeps it interesting is the fact that marketers are really creative and they come up with new ways to sell stuff all the time. And then my job is to figure out where that fits in with respect to regulators and courts and potentially class action lawsuits and things like that.
So let's get into the dumpster fire a little bit, man. You can't tease me with a little bit of California's Privacy Act and some of those frustrations without...
Yeah, I mean, I can't claim to be the expert on privacy law, but there's a guy who... The reason I called it a dumpster fire, first of all, I thought that to myself reading one of the first versions of the California Consumer Privacy Act, the CCPA, when it came out. There's a guy called Eric Goldman who has a blog, and he writes about CCPA stuff all the time. And every time he posts about it, the image he uses on his blog is a dumpster on fire. So, he's with me on that characterization. And the reason that he thinks that and I think that is there are so many provisions in the original and then the revisions to it that obviously were not thought out from what is the effect of this? How can a business practically comply with what we just said they have to comply with without running out of money on compliance issues?
They can't. I'll tell you firsthand, we have a publicly traded institution, we have a website, and just the number of predatory lawsuits and people that come out just looking for technical violations is shocking.
Yeah, and that law in particular and the proposed revisions to it, and there's been so many revisions to it, it's like, okay, as soon as we sort of understand what we're supposed to do to comply with this, now there's this new version that's going to come out that either conflicts with itself internally, or they've just thrown in a new term, like even defining what a sale of personal information is. That seems like a pretty straightforward thing. You either sell someone's email address or you don't. It's not simple. It's like if anyone even has access to a cookie that you've collected through your website, that's maybe a sale. And if it is, then you need to do this and that. And the average cost of compliance with the CCPA, I don't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it's staggering if you actually want to be in compliance to the letter of that law. So, I mean, I don't want to get into it because I'll quickly get out of my depth, but that's the example that springs to mind of like, yeah, new laws are one thing. And then this, the concept of courts dealing with those laws as they're put to the test is a whole nother can of worms.
And for those of you listening, you're like, what the hell are they talking about? Like, how has this impacted my life? You have seen this. This is actually, if you're in California, frankly, anywhere in the United States, you've seen these new cookies pop-ups on every website you go to saying if you'll accept the cookies or if you move forward, you automatically accept it. This has been tangibly felt by everybody on the internet. And it happened almost overnight without anybody really understanding why this was why, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's the GDPR, which has to do with the cookies thing, and then CCPA has requirements about what has to go in a privacy policy, how you have to internally track all of the data that you collect, the do not sell my personal information button, that's a CCPA thing, and it's the sort of thing that is like, almost, it seems like almost intentionally complex just for its own sake. But I think part of the problem is like the legislature realizes people really care about privacy. That's part of the zeitgeist for sure. Everybody wants to not have their information tracked. So let's put out a law that makes it look like we're really on the forefront of protecting privacy. And then it'll be everyone else's problem to figure out what the hell we just wrote. That's kind of a cynical take on it. But if you look at this stuff long enough, that's how it feels.
But the irony is, at the same time, we're all live streaming our lives in the feeds on our Instagram story and on Snapchat. And it's like, we want our privacy, but we want it how we want it, when we want it.
Right.
It's a little weird, right? Like, I mean, we as humans are weird.
I have my own thoughts about, like, the iOS update, where you can choose not to have ads that are relevant to you. It's like, why would I not want that? Why would I want ads that have nothing to do with my tastes and preferences? Like, personally, I would rather have ads that I might care about than ones that I don't. And if the cost of that is that Facebook collects an email address that it can identify with my phone but not my name, fine. Or even if they did know, like, Rob Freund likes this kind of music, great. Like it's concern to me personally.
I get that. The ones that weird me out though is not that. Like, I'm cool with my phone collecting some data. The ones that bother me are like when my wife and I have a conversation about, oh, hey, honey, you need to pick up some baby wipes. And the next ad on my Instagram account is a baby wipe ad. Like, bro, we know you're listening. Like, just say what we're doing here. Like, this is not a coincidence. I didn't search it yet. I haven't Googled it. It was just in the conversation. That's happened, I think, to a lot of us. I want to be mindful of your time. I know we're running up against our set time. I did have some dying questions that I'm just dying to ask you, and I hope you don't mind. You see a lot of entertainment stuff. It's a lot of fascinating stuff. Give me a couple like really fascinating things you've seen as of late that are of interest to you in this space. Like what's some of the stuff that's going on right now? You thinking like, wow, that's interesting. It's cool. It's dynamic. Like what's your top three?
That is a good question. Thinking back, like stuff I posted about recently. One thing that so there's stuff that's interesting to me. I don't know if it'll be interesting to everybody.
That's okay.
There was, and this isn't even about U.S. law. One of the more interesting things I read recently was there's a company that like tunes exotic cars or customizes them. They're called Mansory.
Yeah, very well.
Yeah, if you're into cars, then you probably have a strong opinion about Mansory one way or another. Ferrari sued Mansory and won last week in a European court because Mansory created a body kit that looked like Ferrari's highest performing track only version of the 488, their like FXX model. This is most interesting to me because I'm like such a nerd about cars and it's where all my attention is outside of work. But when I saw a headline that says Ferrari wins lawsuit in European court against Mansory for ripping off the design of their track only version of the car, I thought, wow, that is a really interesting trade dress issue. And it also reminded me of just how aggressively Ferrari polices its IP as a brand. They're notorious for that. Philip Klein for even using a Ferrari in ads for his shoes because they just don't like him and decided to like declare war on him. They tried to go after Deadmau5 for like rebadging his 458 and putting like a Deadmau5 badge on it instead of the horse.
Which is insane to me. You could sue somebody for doing that to their own property.
Right. Yeah. So it's an interesting lesson in not only like car related stuff, but also the choice of a brand to hyper aggressively police their intellectual property or not. Like some brands will do that and they don't care if there's public backlash about it. Others are a little bit less interested in doing that.
Well, look at the Porsche community. Those guys, I mean, they're supported by the brand. They want you to be out there tuning and doing things. I mean, Rod Emery has an entire business based on customizing classic body Porsches.
Right.
You know, he's supported.
And RWB and the Porsche community is amazing.
So what we're saying is we both need Porsches is what I'm hearing.
Right. Yeah. If somebody would like to give me a GT3, that would be amazing.
I'll take a classic 911 so we don't have any problems.
Yeah. There's that. And then I think just more generally, the ramping up from the FTC in the last month over sending out thousands of letters, putting people on notice for things like customer reviews, endorsement disclosures, earnings claims. All that is interesting to me because when that happens, there's FTC actions that follow that. And that it's with the new, there's new people in charge of the FTC and they've sort of declared, we're going to be way more aggressive than the previous iteration. And during COVID, their priorities sort of shifted. They're more paying more attention and rightfully so to things like price gouging and fake COVID cures and stuff that's, I think most people would agree, more harmful than an influencer not using hashtag ad. But now that it seems like we're hopefully turning the corner on the pandemic a bit, plus this new more either consumer-friendly or anti-business, depending on how you look at it, group of people in charge. It's going to be really interesting next 12 months after all these sorts of shots across the bow have been fired.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I'm glad to hear it. Frankly, I'd love to see the FTC get built up and for a new regime to come in and do what they're doing. I support them 100,000%, and I hope that they're successful. My last question for you, I saw the other day you posted about shipping delays possibly having, you know, punitive repercussions for the person who's supposed to be shipping you product. And there could be consequences for that.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, what a fascinating thing in a world where Amazon is a thing, but the U.S. Postal Service is slowing down. Could you spend like a couple minutes just breaking down what that looks like?
Yeah. So this is one of those issues where there's the FTC's rule, which applies no matter where you are in the country. And then different states have their own versions of that have either additional or different requirements. You can pretty much always trust that California is going to need to come up with its own version of whatever the FTC rule is just to make things more difficult. So this has to do with the FTC's mail order rule. And California has its own version of it. But the general premise is if you're shipping products and you do not tell people a shipping window, like if your website says ships in 50 days or something, then all right, you've told people what the window is. If you don't say, then the default is 30 days and you have to ship your product within 30 days. And if you realize that you're not going to be able to do that, there's a series of notices that you have to send to your customers that either allow them to cancel or allow them to just wait for your new anticipated deadline if you have one. And if you can't meet the new deadline, there's another notice that has to go out and so forth. So it's not like if there's supply chains and you can't ship, then you're going to get screwed. It's like if you recognize that you're not going to meet the window you've advertised, then there's certain things you have to let people know and options you have to give them. And brands that have not complied with that have been hit with really, really hefty fines for that. So the thing I posted about was the state of California going after Yeezy's shoe company for that exact thing. It's not like just because everything's stuck in the port, he's not able to get the shoes to people. It's that he didn't provide the notices to the customers that, hey, there's going to be a delay more than 30 days and didn't meet California's version of that rule. And that's another one of those things where it's like, who would know that unless you're out there like reading legal blogs or, I guess, following an attorney on social media? So I'm sympathetic to, like, if I started a shoe company, I'm not sure that I would be aware of that and know that this needs to be out there. And if it weren't for hiring a legal team that focuses on e-commerce, I probably wouldn't be aware of that rule. And who would? But it's one of those things that is enforced from time to time, could conceivably be the basis for a class action, and can just become a mess over whether you did or didn't send an email.
And I would not have known that, honestly, myself, had I not have actually followed you on Instagram. And why don't you share like the best way for people to follow you? Your content's so good. It's so short and so brief that it's been super helpful for me, frankly. There's a lot of things I've done. I've been like, oh, shit, I should probably call Robert on this one.
Yeah, it's my name and then law. So it's at Robert Freund Law. That's F-R-E-U-N-D. And I'm most active on there. I'll get around to TikTok sometime later this year, hopefully. But yeah, for now, that's probably the best way to get in touch with me. If you send me a DM, I'll try to get back to you. Otherwise, you can visit my website, robertfreundlaw.com, and there's a way to book a consultation through there.
But the man is busy, so be prepared to get on the guy's calendar. He's got a lot going on these days. And with all the stuff that we're seeing in the internet, you're probably going to be busy for a while.
Yeah, I don't see it slowing down, so that's a good thing.
Well, Robert, I sincerely appreciate you coming on board. It's been a pleasure. I can't wait to have you on again. We can talk about all the crazy stuff that's happened since the last time we talked.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun. Right. I'd love to do it again.
All right, take care, man. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation on the Higher Standard Podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe or follow on whatever platform you are listening to this on. If you like this episode, please write a review and share it with us. We're getting the show up and running right now, so every message, every review, and every note counts. This show exists to showcase what's possible when leaders decide to uphold a higher standard for their businesses, their investments, their families, and most importantly, themselves. If you want to see more of my content, I post daily on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, so be sure to follow me on your favorite social media platform. And with that, it is a wrap. And as always, I look forward to hanging with you all on the next episode.